Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. To Kill a Mockingbird won a Pulitzer Prize for the author Harper Lee, inspired a classic movie starring Gregory Peck, and defined how many think of decency and bigotry in the American South. Aaron Sorkin's new stage adaptation has shattered records on Broadway. The actor Jeff Daniels has just secured a Tony nomination for his depiction of Atticus Finch. Yet they've done more than that. Together, they have re-envisioned an American classic. This hour, On Point, the actor Jeff Daniels joins me in studio for a freewheeling conversation. This time, the man is unscripted. Join us. I'm talking to Jeff Daniels about Atticus Finch, To Kill a Mockingbird, race, and acting on stage and on screen. What questions do you have? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With me, as I said, here in studio is Jeff Daniels. He's an Emmy Award-winning actor and star of the Broadway hit To Kill a Mockingbird. He's been just been nominated for a Tony Award for Best Male Lead in a play for that role. Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Atticus Finch, To Kill a Mockingbird, what drew you to this role?
It's Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird. It's one of the great... He is one of the great iconic heroes, albeit fictional. I mean, he's you people put him up on Mount Rushmore. They put him next to Washington and Lincoln, and they revere him. And they get the opportunity to originate the role on Broadway in a script by Aaron Sorkin was a no-brainer, regardless of Gregory Peck and the success that Mr. Peck had with it. You don't walk away from an opportunity like that.
I want to give listeners a couple tastes of what it's like to attend. I got to see the production some days ago and was very stirred. You know, you laugh at points during it. You ache at points during it. It's a very stirring production. In this scene, Atticus Finch is questioned by his daughter, Scout, about the upcoming trial where he'll represent a local African-American sharecropper who's been falsely accused of raping a white woman in the small town of Macomb, Alabama. And in many ways, this is the fulcrum. This is the crucial point of the play. Scout is portrayed by Celia Keenan-Bolger.
Atticus.
Ma'am.
Everyone in town says they're right and you're wrong.
Just about, yes.
Well, don't they usually mean that they're right and you're wrong?
No. There's an old saying, a person is smart. People are dumb. A mob acts out of emotion. Absent facts, absent contemplation, mostly absent responsibility. What they get in return is anonymity. Conscience can be exhausting. It'll keep you up at night. Mob's a place where people go to take a break from their conscience.
And for Macomb, Alabama, it seems to me that Atticus Finch is, in some ways, its living conscience, right? That there's this the person they look to in some ways for wisdom.
Yeah, he is. He's the guy you go to get something fixed or get a legal thing. You don't have the money, and you can pay him in vegetables. And he is kind of a touchstone. But he also sits on his porch. He also steers clear of it all. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get involved in changing Monroeville or changing – that's what's different about the play. Atticus comes to that. He's got a lot of good advice, but actually getting off the porch and going and changing things is something he comes to in the play versus, you assume that he's just going to go save the day from page one. He's just in the play, he's a small-town lawyer, gets paid in vegetables. One day the judge comes over and says, will you – represent this black guy who's accused of wrongfully of raping a white woman, white girl. Would you? And he's got to get off his porch, and it's 100% chance. The guy's 100% innocent. And Atticus's belief that there's goodness in everyone and your better angel will win out, much like it says in the Bible, and the good in us will always overtake the bad. And that's not how it works out.
There's an exchange early on in the play between Jem, Atticus's son, Jeremy, and Scout, who is a, they're sort of all the kids who are played by brilliantly by adult actors, but all the kids are kind of the joint narrators, the Greek chorus that propels the play forward in many ways. But there's this exchange where Jem's talking to the audience. He says, "Our father was wise and kind and a scholar, but when it came to confrontation, he was meek." And Scout defensively says, "He wasn't meek." Jem says, "I didn't say weak, did I? I said meek. A weak person can't fight. A meek person won't fight. But Makem was in the fight of its life. Atticus says there's fundamental goodness in everyone, and I say being polite is no way to win a war." You guys really elevated, you know, Aaron Sorkin, and your portrayal as well, and you're no doubt crafting this with him as he brought the play to Broadway. You guys elevate this tension about Atticus Finch in a way that's very different than what people might have taken from Gregory Peck's sort of certitude or the book as presented by Harper Lee, it feels to me.
It's a different point of view. The book and the movie took Scout at the age of 8, I believe, and you're looking up. You're looking up at Atticus. Yeah, he's on Mount Rushmore. He's already on a pedestal. And we took the pedestal away. He still believes what he believes. He's still a very righteous man, a very decent man, a very honest man. But he's just a small-town lawyer who gets paid in vegetables. And one day the judge comes over and changes his life. You come at Atticus in the play from eye level versus looking up at Mount Rushmore, and that it's the same guy, but he, you know, the play, he becomes Atticus in the play. He is an Atticus on page one.
He evolves into the role that he was meant to play in some ways.
Yeah, that's kind of what we did. And by taking that approach, you then there's a struggle to hang on to decency and respect and compassion and all of that. It isn't just assumed and, you know, happy endings. It isn't. He walks face first into a wall of resistance.
Aaron Sorkin has talked a bit publicly about this. Aaron Sorkin, of course, the Emmy and Oscar award-winning screenwriter, playwright, your collaborator on the HBO show The Newsroom, we can talk a bit about later on. He wrote this version, To Kill a Mockingbird. He talked about his inspiration in some ways. He talked last month at an event for the New York Times at which he explained that his conception of Atticus was influenced by modern times and specifically, interestingly, President Trump's response to the violent white supremacist protest that tore through Charlottesville, Virginia in the summer of 2017.
When I would go to the book and read Atticus saying that there is goodness in everyone, goodness can be found in everyone, suddenly it started to sound too much to me like there were fine people on both sides. Now, I know that those two men are coming from two very different places when they say that. But I was angry and I was frustrated and I wanted Atticus to pick a damn side already. We need Atticus Finch on our side. We don't need him pointing out the goodness in everyone.
Now, you know, I've got three girls, and I try to teach my kids that the idea of empathy being kind of a supreme human value, the ability, you know, I don't know that I would put it quite the way that it's put by Atticus, where you got to walk a mile in somebody else's skin before you can criticize them. But yeah. The idea that, you know.
The kids don't buy that either.
Yeah, I bet they don't.
His kids.
Well, I'm not sure my kids always buy it, but Nonetheless, you try to instill that, and yet here he's saying that can be a virtue so blinding it's a flaw.
Yeah. There isn't goodness in everyone, and I think that's certainly challenged today in 2019. And the better angel will not win out all the time. There is power, there is money, there is control, there is dominance, and that has nothing to do with being empathetic. And I agree with Aaron. Atticus has to pick a side. He has to get off the porch. We need him now. We need his voice. And he's forced to do so by taking this case.
I want to play a clip from a scene in which he meets his client that indicates that reluctance to get off the porch. Atticus gets assigned a case by the sympathetic local judge. His client is Tom Robinson. That's the African-American sharecropper who's been falsely accused of raping a young white woman. Robinson is portrayed by the actor Benga Akinabe.
I'm a lawyer. I know the facts of your case. If you so choose, I will defend you in open court in front of a jury. Not so much your peers, but still, a group of people to whom a not guilty verdict is available.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah, I wasn't able to follow that either. I can't tell you how to plead, but I can and I must give you my best advice.
You want to be my lawyer now?
Tom, very last thing I want in the world be your lawyer right now. Negro man, white teenage girl, I wouldn't be going in with a winning hand. But I'm compelled to defend you as an officer of the court. And in that capacity, I've taken a solemn oath to give you my best counsel, which is that you cannot and you must not plead guilty and go to jail for a crime that you did not and could not commit.
Now, obviously, this is a play about the 1930s, a small, dusty town in Alabama. Language is going to be a little different than it might be now. But it sounds to me as though you feel the issues continue to echo today.
Yeah. Yeah, they do.
What do you think the play does for those who come to see it? What are you hoping that they get from it?
The thing that a play can do that the movie and the book can't, you can't put it down. You can't hit pause. You can't come back to it later. You're in the room. They shut the doors. And when Tom Robinson is found guilty, you're in the room when he's found guilty. And everything that you feel about that, which is usually you can't believe it. Even though you know the story, being in the room when Benga has to get up and is handcuffed and led off to jail and eventually the electric chair, you know where he's going. And you can see him and that long walk across the stage as they take him out after he loses the case. You feel it in a way that you don't necessarily feel it in the book and the movie. And that's one of the things we worked hard on with this play was I want you to feel it. I want you to get hit with it. I want you to walk out changed. And 7 months of performances and people are walking out changed.
We're discussing To Kill a Mockingbird with the star of the Broadway smash, Jeff Daniels. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for Jeff Daniels about Atticus Finch, Harper Lee's work in adapting such a well-known book for the stage? What questions do you have about Jeff Daniels' earlier roles, whether The Newsroom, Gods of Carnage, Dumb and Dumber? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the iconic American story, To Kill a Mockingbird, its enduring contribution to discussions about race in the U.S., how it plays to a modern ear, its most recent stage incarnation, and more. You can join our conversation. What's your question for Jeff Daniels about his life in front of the camera as well as on stage? With me, Jeff Daniels, the Emmy Award-winning actor and star of the Broadway play, To Kill a Mockingbird. As I mentioned before the show, I saw you in God of Carnage. People may not know that you're actually quite dedicated to the theater. You did not live the life of Hollywood even after breaking through, moved back, I believe, to Chelsea, Michigan, mm-hmm. and founded the Purple Rose Theater there, mm-hmm. named after a great film you were in, The Purple Rose of Cairo. Tell me about your dedication to the stage and to writing for the stage as well as being involved in productions as an actor.
It's where I started. I started in high school musicals and community theater musicals and college dramas and came to New York and went to Off-Broadway. I didn't get in a car and drive to Hollywood. That's where I started, and that's where I stayed. There's something about the artistry of the theater that is something that just survives through the cracks of a movie or a TV series. There are so many people that get their hands on it. You have more artistic control at a play, certainly at Circle Repertory Company off Broadway or at the Purple Rose. We don't have focus groups. We don't have marketing people coming in going, you need to change the title because it won't sell. None of that. So there, I enjoy that kind of creative freedom where it's on us to do something that holds an audience starting at 8 o'clock tonight. And the theater has that for me. And I've come back to New York. I've come back to Broadway. Scott Rudin is, as a producer in the last 10 years, has shown as much faith in me as, you know, his faith in me is second only to that of maybe Aaron and my representatives and my family. He's just been, we're going to get you back. We want you to do Mockingbird. We want you to do Blackbird. We want you to do God of Carnage. And there's a artistry that happens in New York on Broadway when you've got to deliver it 8 times a week. And there's a pride that comes with that. There's an obligation that comes with that. There's a responsibility that comes with that to show up and hit it out of the park eight times a week. You can't come in and hit a single. You can't do that. And the theater demands that of you. You can get away with more in front of a camera. They won't use that take. Not in the theater.
So for two reasons, I want you to tell me. You told me before we started about your last 24 hours, just itemize. I mean, people think, hey, he's a big star. He can get a table wherever he wants in Broadway. You know, it's probably like you are getting worked, man. So tell me about your last 24 hours.
Well, it's the Tonys, and I've been nominated. And
so
it's
to argue.
Always good to get invited to the dance. You know, now I just got to get a dress. If you're proud of what you do, that's how I look at all this campaigning. If you're proud of what you've done, you want people to know about it. So, I've been everywhere. And
but the kinds of things you've been doing have been pretty interesting to me. You went and you gave a college talk. You also did. You did two performances yesterday. I was told earlier that you might have had a day off yesterday. Not the case.
No.
You did two performances. But tell me about the differences in the audiences.
Well, I gave a commencement address at Kane University, which I worked on. I worked hard on that. I wrote it. And, you're the guy playing Atticus Finch on Broadway. Go ahead. Uh-huh. And you got to deliver a message that isn't, you don't become Atticus, but you have a responsibility to kind of, maybe you've learned something, you might want to pass it on to these young kids. So that's how I took yesterday morning. Then we had a student matinee for 1,400, I'm going to assume 8th graders,
uh-huh,
from New York City, about as diverse as an audience as you're going to get. And that's a different audience. What's great about the kids is that they're into it. They're listening. They may talk. They may hear something a line and, I can't believe he just said, yeah, you hear the blah, 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 blah. It's what I imagine Shakespeare back at the Globe Theater, in, you know, centuries ago, where the audience would talk back to the characters.
Right, the groundlings.
There's a little bit of that.
Right?
There's a little bit of that. And there's a physical altercation later in the play, in the second act, that Atticus has with Bob Ewell. And when we get into that, you can't hear a word we're saying, because 1,400 kids are reacting as if Superman in his cape just flew down.
Did you see that? You know, they're kind of astounded to see this physical action from the lawyer who wants to stay on the porch.
Yeah, and he's suddenly in this physical altercation, and they're cheering me like I'm Superman coming down from the clouds, and I'm saving the day. And I've got this speech that I have to spit into Bob Ewell's ear. You don't hear a word of it, because the kids are, get it, oh, yeah. I mean, it's 1,400 of them, and it's great. It's terrific. The other thing, too, about the student matinees is that there are give or take 20 teachers out there chaperoning on a teacher's salary. My daughter's a teacher, public school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I know what they make. And a Broadway ticket is too expensive for that salary. This is their chance to see Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah, they've got a section full of kids that they're trying to keep off their iPhones and all of this stuff. But it's their chance to see the play. And so you throw it at the kids, but also the teachers. And, you know, in a way, it's thanking them for doing what they do.
I want to take a couple of calls now on this the subject, this production from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Matt's on the air. Matt, join us. You're here on the line with Jeff Daniels.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Good. I'm a very big fan of your work. Thanks so much for all the incredible work that you've put out over the years. And I come from teaching as well, at high school here in Oklahoma City. And To Kill a Mockingbird was on our book list. We read it every single year. It's by far my favorite book of all time. I have such a great affinity for it. But one of the things that I would get blowback from every year without fail was I wouldn't edit myself as I would read it. I would present it as it was presented by Harper Lee. And as I would get blowback from that, I would tell them, I really believe that she wrote this using the words that she did because she wanted you to feel the weight of that content. She wanted you to feel how nasty some of those words were and how they truly made that culture feel in Macomb there. But I wanted to know, does that affect your performances at all? Do you get blowback from some of that content where people think, you know, maybe we've talked about this for too long, or maybe this isn't the right place to talk about these kinds of things?
Well, for us, it basically boils down to the N-word. And the N-word was normal in the 30s, certainly in white Alabama. It was used as if you were just, you know, any other word. And our job as actors is to find that and let that be kind of how we approach it. It should be a reaction to an audience. Now, it should get pin some ears back of the audience. You know, kids, as a teacher with kids, I can see why there are parents and administrators going, let's just get that book out of there because it's just too tough and we don't want anything that's going to, you know, be controversial on that. And I agree with you. I think Harper wanted people to feel it, kids to feel it, adults to feel it.
The discomfort.
Yeah, yeah. That's all part of it. And it certainly is part of the play. And again, what I, you know, people are in and bang, we're using that word, and white people and the white characters are using that word in the play, and it's jarring for them. And but that's the way it was, and that's part of sucking you into that world that makes you pulls you in and then punches you right in the face when Harper's story kind of rolls out. I understand the frustration of Matt, but it's you know, there's a reason why she wrote it the way she wrote it.
That going to help you with parents, Matt?
No.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think so. It's still a tough sell. I think that, but at the same time, you're right. What literature is all about is saying, let me take you into this world and let me make you feel everything that I can possibly make you feel with words on a page. And if the goal is achieved and if you come away with a higher respect for a culture that maybe you didn't have respect for, I think it's worth it.
Thanks so much for your call, Matt. I want to take one more call now from Scituate, Massachusetts. Mark, tell us your thoughts on this.
Hi. I really just wanted to thank Jeff Daniels specifically for his work on To Kill a Mockingbird. I am the grandson of the civil rights leader, Whitney Young. And I have three biracial daughters, and you know, I'm afforded a great deal of privilege. And you know, we live in a really nice community. And my 15-year-old daughter was on a theater trip to New York City, and she texted me after that show, and she said that was the most meaningful thing I've ever seen. And this is, you know, having seen it as having seen the movie, having read the book, we just adopted a dog from Alabama and we named her Harper. you know, so she knows there's unfairness in the world, and it's not always easy to expose kids from communities like ours to, you know, to diversity, to be able to understand that there is unfairness and to be empathetic. And so to have her text me after that, just let me know that, you know, the performance must have been a doozy. Because for a 15-year-old kid to text her dad and say, you know, that was the most meaningful thing I've ever seen, says a lot, I think.
Well, I appreciate that. Night after night after night, I watch 1,400 mainly white Americans get their ears pinned back. They're experiencing injustice, racial injustice, racism. I mean, you go to LaTanya and Benga, Shona, some of the Doran, the African American members of the cast, and they kind of go, yeah, this is a surprise to you, and it is to white America. I had no idea it felt this badly. Well, yeah, that's kind of what it felt like back then, and what it feels like right now. Welcome to being, you know, it's a wake up call for white America. That's what this play really does.
Mark, I want to thank you for that call. Also acknowledge for the listeners who might not be aware, Whitney Young was a really noted American civil rights leader. Your grandfather spent most of his career working to end employment discrimination in the U.S. and turned the National Urban League into really a fighting force and a major civil rights organization here. So thanks for that call about through the generations about the influence here. I want to play a clip that gets at something that Mark acknowledged. There's a point during a trial. It's a pivotal cross-examination where Atticus is questioning Bob Yule. He's the father of the accuser of Tom Robinson, who's making this false accusation. Bob Yule is portrayed by the actor Frederick Weller.
Mr. Yule, you were doing a lot of running that night. You say you ran to the house, ran to the window, ran inside, ran to Mayella, ran for Mr. Tate. Did you run for a doctor?
Your Honor, I'd like to state that this man and me had a post-ergo hoc conversation outside his house, which I believe makes him disqualified from asking me questions.
Judge, the witness came to my house. We had a nice chat during which he threatened to lynch the defendant and me, and I made up some Latin words to end the conversation politely.
It's a pretty funny moment, and yet that funny moment envelops and embraces a pretty stark truth that he's cross-examining a guy who's willing to lynch people, particularly willing to lynch black people and anyone who would help them. Mm-hmm. And there is the question of race that hangs over both the subjects you guys are exploring and the very nature of performing this. Your colleague Benga Akinabi, who plays Tom Robinson, had, I thought, a very moving piece in the Washington Post that I'm sure mm-hmm, you read as well. And sure, you've talked through 1,000 times, between rehearsals and on, you know, off and on the stage. He wrote in part, it's headlined, "Every night racists kill me, then I leave the theater for a world of danger." Obviously an African-American actor. He said, "What has surprised me is how much it hurts my heart to tell this black man's story with its inevitable end for the nightly consumption of this audience. I didn't realize how desperate I'd be for the comforting faces of people of color in the sold-out 1,435-seat Schubert Theater. I know that black people who come to this place share the pain I experience on stage in a way white theater goers cannot." And I think Sorkin at some event was asked a little bit about, you know, the way in which the characters were allowed to breathe and evolve, the way in which the African-American characters, Calpurnia and Tom Robinson, were given much more agency, a much stronger sense of who they were. But this was still very much a play in some ways about white people, right?
For white people, I would say four.
So tell me about that.
Well, it's not news to Benga and LaTanya and Calpurnia and Tom that this is how black people are treated. This is not news. This is not a news flash. This is not an, oh my God, what a story. I had no idea. They've lived it for decades, centuries maybe. So you know, in a lot of ways today, America is Atticus sitting on the porch. We have to decide whether we want to get off the porch or not.
Convinced of our fundamental decency, but sitting on the porch.
Or is it enough to just sit on the porch and go, I believe in goodness in everyone, and then I'm going to go about my day? The border wall is something that happens in Texas. I'm not from Texas, so that doesn't really affect me. But I'm all for it. What am I getting for lunch today? You know, we don't stick to it. It doesn't last. And Mockingbird, the play, stays with people. They leave and they question and they're moved by it, and they, like the 15-year-old daughter of the guy, you know, saying it's the most powerful thing I've ever seen, or words to that effect. That's hitting white people right between the eyes. Now, what are you going to do about it? What are you going to do with that? Are you going to sit on the porch, or are you going to, you know, maybe go about changing things?
And briefly before the end of this segment, does that production then and that conception of Mockingbird endure past the moment we're in and the age we're finding ourselves in?
Go past it?
Yeah. Does it endure past the moment of crisis that Aaron and you have sort of seen and say in some ways this is a response to?
Definitely a response to it. Definitely a response to it. Absolutely. This is, you going to get off the porch or not?
We're discussing the Broadway play To Kill a Mockingbird with its star, Jeff Daniels. We're also going to discuss his prolific career on the stage, TV, and silver screen. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have for Jeff Daniels, the star of Terms of Endearment, The Newsroom, Dumb and Dumber, and far more? What performance sticks with you? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the roles, career, and life of Jeff Daniels, the stage and film star currently appearing in the Broadway hit show To Kill a Mockingbird, where he's starring as Atticus Finch. You can join the conversations. What questions do you have for Jeff Daniels? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. As I say, with me here in studio in New York City, Jeff Daniels, the Emmy Award-winning actor, star of the Broadway play To Kill a Mockingbird. We're getting responses online as well as calls pouring in. Gia's not there. It's posting under that Twitter handle. Says, I live in Brunswick, Maine, home of Bowdoin College and the Joshua Chamberlain Museum. Mm. I just wanted to thank Mr. Daniels for his amazing portrayal of Colonel Chamberlain's in two movies, Gettysburg and God and Generals.
Is yes. Right? I've been to that. I've been to the Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain Museum in Brunswick.
Yeah. Did you sport the mustache at that point? Because that was some impressive.
It was in Gettysburg. It was a fake one, but it was a good one. Yeah. It was all about the facial hair in Gettysburg, whether you had good facial hair or bad facial hair.
Well, Gia says, I love his acting. Appreciate the time and care he put in the role. Mark the Seventh writes, my general assumption, if Jeff Daniels is playing a role in something, it's going to be good. Mean Girl writes, given the rise of bigotry, white supremacy, and intolerance in this country, the presentation of To Kill a Mockingbird is timely. I want to go to the phones for a little bit from Auburn, Alabama. Carolyn is on the line. Carolyn?
Hey, I was wanting to thank Mr. Daniels and Adam Sorkin for getting Atticus off Mount Rushmore. In this state, Harper Lee, Miss Nell, is a literary icon. Her sister, Miss Alice, is an icon of the Methodist Church. This thing, it's become almost cast in amber. And I would hate for To Kill a Mockingbird to be Pride and Prejudice or, you know, something like this. Those were real people. The situations they're writing about are real. And it just seemed to me in recent years, everybody's reading it, but it's losing the reality, the hard reality of it. And I just want to thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. And that's what the play does. Like I was saying earlier, the hard reality of feeling what's going on in the story. We're able to do that on stage because you're locked in a theater and we don't stop, we don't pause, you don't put the book down. And we approach it like Atticus is a human being with strengths and weaknesses, and mostly strengths, but there are the flaws. And it makes him human, relatable, and accessible, and more emotionally impactful for the audience.
Before we move on, I wanted to play a clip. Gregory Peck won an Oscar for his portrayal of Atticus Finch in the movie version of To Kill a Mockingbird, which came out in 1962. Here is Peck's Atticus explaining the importance of empathy to his daughter Scout.
Just learn a single trick, Scout. You get along a lot better with all kinds of folks. You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view.
Sir?
Till you climb inside of his skin, walk around in it.
Now, I talked a little bit earlier and asked you a bit about the question of empathy and all that. To me, I wanted to ask you a bit about Gregory Peck. I mean, I used to do an impression of Gregory Peck that consisted entirely of saying, Scout. You know, it's
pretty good.
Thanks.
Pretty good.
So, you know, like, he's a pretty tough guy as a person not thinking to play the role to get out of your head for that. How do you approach taking over a role that was so defined in a performative way by such a well-known figure?
I never let him in. I had seen the movie maybe as a kid. I don't really remember it. I had not read the book until Aaron Sorkin said, would you like to play Atticus? It was not on the reading list at the school I went to. But I watched the movie one more time in like a year and a half ago just to see his choices, because as Robert De Niro says, an actor is only as good as his choices. And I wanted to see how he chose to do like that clip right there,
mm-hmm.
You know, where he put the emphasis, how he, you know, where the pauses are and all that. I watched it once to see what he did, but I didn't want to know any more about what he did because this isn't the Horton Foote screenplay that we're doing.
It sure isn't.
And so it would have been a disservice, a distraction, an impediment to have him in the room with me every day I was working on this. So with all due respect to him, I hit the delete button. And I looked at the role as if I were originating it. When it comes to Aaron Sorkin's play on Broadway, I was originating it. I am originating it. And so that's the approach I took, right or wrong, good or bad. So when all the book people came in that first month of performances and held the book against their chest saying, please don't ruin this for me, we walked out going, well, we might. Boom. Here it is. And we got up and over them.
And, you know, you did that and you had to, you know, Joel Rudin and others had to get through the estates issues as well. And yet I think this very much honors the spirit, but does update it. Melanie Holloway, one of our listeners, posts online, I love your point that America is Atticus. Get off the porch, America, she writes. Want to take a call from Kingsport, Tennessee right now. Dylan, thanks for joining us. What's your question for Jeff Daniels?
Hi. I just had a question. I grew up watching Dumb and Dumber and just loving his comedy and everything else. I just wonder how does Jeff Daniels become Atticus? How does he become somebody as serious as that, coming from, you know, being a comedian and everything else? How is he able to do so many roles and be so serious, especially in some show that's as serious that's going on right now with all the issues and everything going on with the U.S.?
Well, obviously I need therapy. I have likened it to kind of legalized schizophrenia. My little trick is to keep it simple, to not bring what I've done before into the rehearsal room for this particular project, whatever that may be. Start fresh. That's what we did in theater. Off-Broadway, way back in the 70s, 80s, no one ever asked, hey, could you do that thing you did in the last play, just do it for us? That's what you hear in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
You hear, where's your mark, where's your brand, what's that thing you do, just do it for us. Theater was brand new every time. And the way I would get into people would be to, you know, you do all the preparation, the reading, the work, the memorization, the staging, all that stuff. And then eventually you've got to think like Atticus. What's Atticus thinking about when he's not speaking? Is he listening? What's he thinking about what Scout's saying? What's he, you know, when Bob Yule is on his porch kind of trying to, you know, convince Atticus to just let this all go, what are you thinking about? It's that inner monologue that actors have. And even someone as stupid as Harry Dunn in Dumb and Dumber with an IQ of 8 has thoughts. He has thoughts going through his head. So if you can think like the characters a little bit, then other things will happen, and then you kind of become this other person. It's just adult make-believe. That's all it is. But it's an internal thing where you trick yourself in believing you're really either Atticus Finch or as stupid as Harry Dunn.
Are they still both fun?
Fun?
Yeah. I mean, I know it's a job. It's your avocation. It's your profession. It pays the bills. It does other things. It's still – do you get enjoyment? Do you get fulfillment?
It's a
you describe this as therapy. I'll tell you when the 50 minutes are up. But,
yeah.
You know,
excellent. It's a challenge.
Uh-huh.
It's still a challenge. I'm still interested in it. It's what I do. I've worked 42 years to get as good as I can be at this. And everything I've ever learned, I bring with Atticus. And so there's this – it's kind of like, you know, is surgery fun? Yes and no. But there's this skill and this technique and this training that comes into every night when you go on stage. And so it's this execution of everything you've learned about this particular field. It's fun when it works. And most often it works if you've done the preparation, which goes with anything, not just with being an actor. If you've prepared and if you've outworked everybody else, and particularly outworked yourself, so there is no way that anyone could do this better, you have convinced yourself of that, then you're ready to walk out on stage. Then it's fun.
I read somewhere that you said that you memorized the lines for this about 3 months before opening. You just said you needed to have that in your head, you know, locked in.
That was to beat Gregory Peck and to beat the critics.
Uh-huh.
And it's an athletic thing. You see all these guys in training camp and football and this and that. They spend months getting ready for that first game. I take the same approach. Mm-hmm. And with the heat that was on this, with he's going up, he's trying to do what Gregory Peck did, and then the curtain goes up, and the critics are sitting there, and you have to be five times more prepared than the guy who taught the book that's sitting in row eight, or the critic sitting there who's you know, boned up and gotten ready to really review the Mockingbird thing. They've done some research on it. You have to be way ahead of those guys in order to look out at them and go, keep up.
I want to go from row eight at the Schubert Theater to line five, a call from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Dean, go ahead. What's your question for Jeff Daniels?
Hi, my wife and I loved you in the newsroom, and specifically the first scene where you come out and you say that America isn't the greatest country in the world anymore. Do you feel that this play is kind of a response to try to do a course correct to make America one of the greatest countries in the world again?
I think it challenges those who watch it, just like those who watch that speech in newsroom. It's what art's supposed to do. We aren't here to provide you the answer. We can provide what we think. But then you need to walk out and go, what do I think about that? Do I agree with that? Do I not agree with that? Do I think there's work to be done? Are we the greatest country in the world? Maybe we're not. Did they have good points? If we can get you thinking on your way home, then we're more than just entertainment. Then we're art. Then we've done our job.
So thank you so much for that. I appreciate that call and that question Dean. Let's talk about the newsroom for a moment. It was also a collaboration with Aaron Sorkin,
mm-hmm.
a political drama series on HBO from 2012 to 2014. You starred as the anchor Will McAvoy for the Atlantis cable news channel, ACN. The exterior of that was filmed at the Bank of America building, just a half block from NPR's offices here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scene in which there's a panel discussion you're staged, I think, at a university, and you respond, and it's the speech that our caller was talking about. You're responding to a college student who's asking you why you think America is the greatest country – why you think America is the greatest country in the world. You kind of deflect the question at first, but after pressure from the moderator, you change your approach.
There is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world. We're 7th in literacy, 27th in math, 22nd in science, 49th in life expectancy, 178th in infant mortality, 3rd in median household income, number 4 in labor force, and number 4 in exports. We lead the world in only three categories: number of incarcerated citizens per capita, number of adults who believe angels are real, and defense spending, where we spend more than the next 26 countries combined, 25 of whom are allies. Now, none of this is the fault of a 20-year-old college student, but you nonetheless are, without a doubt, a member of the worst period generation period ever, period. So when you ask what makes us the greatest country in the world, I don't know what the you're talking about.
Jim Daniels, I see you laughing and shaking your head.
All those numbers. You got to memorize all those numbers. Yeah, it's bringing it all back.
You're saying, thanks, Aaron. Appreciate that.
No, it's what makes it great. It's that this kind of data, these kind of numbers, this kind of specificity is in Will McAvoy's head. I love that.
Will McAvoy is, the conceit is he's an outraged Republican with decent, impulses that lead him perhaps in some ways to a more liberal point of view. It seems as though there's a little bit of Olbermann, a little bit of Joe Scarborough, some other folks tossed in there. To be fair to the student, like, she's not the one who didn't deal with global warming, right? Like,
no, but McAvoy isn't worrying about what's fair to the student.
Right. No, I think that's actually a very fair point. How would McAvoy deal with covering the current moment?
Hard to say without Aaron writing it for me. I think he would be on the attack. He reminded me, I never studied the guys you mentioned. I didn't study anyone. I felt that where we were heading with McAvoy, and I was guessing that I probably didn't want to say that I sat down with, say, a Brian Williams and really shadowed him for 3 years and then basically was throwing cell phones at cameras, and that looks bad for someone that you study. So I didn't study anybody. But Tim Russert on Meet the Press, when you sat down across from Tim Russert, there was no escaping. And he pressed, and he, if you talked around it or gave him a talking point, he came right through that like with a truck. And that's McAvoy. Mm-hmm. That's what I, as McAvoy came to during the three seasons as the show evolved, and also probably would be what's going on now. He would be a tough interview for whether it's Trump, whether it's, anybody on his staff. I don't think Kellyanne Conway would get away with what she's getting away with if she were sitting across from Will McAvoy.
An honest broker.
Your feet are being held to the fire, mm-hmm. and we're turning it up.
In the minute or so we got left, where do you find truth and meaning right now in an age where you find so much that causes you some kind of pain about our contemporary moment?
I find it in the artists. I'm waiting for it out of Washington. It is a very complicated, dangerous time. To impeach, not to impeach. I don't know enough about Washington and what's at stake. I do know what I want, which is honest and accountability and rule of law and all that. I want that. I don't know the best way to get to that, but I wish it would happen tomorrow.
But you find meaning in artists.
Frank Rich wrote something after 9/11. I forget the magazine. But 6 weeks after 9/11, he wrote an article saying, "Where are the artists?" And we need you now. We need you to illuminate what this is, reflect on what this is, help us understand what just happened. And I remember Springsteen doing an interview and driving around New Jersey, and he was at a light or something, and somebody pulled up next to him and leaned out the window and said, "We need you now." Mm-hmm. And Springsteen wrote The Rising. That's what I feel that the American theater is doing with Mockingbird.
You've been hearing the words of Jeff Daniels, star of the Broadway play To Kill a Mockingbird. Jeff Daniels, so delighted to have you here in studio for the show today.
Thank you very much.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point's produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Down, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Mana, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from David Marino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.